Stopping. Almost everyone is sitting.
Yeah, it's working.
Yeah. Okay. Good morning, everyone. I hope you all had a good night yesterday. It's my pleasure to chair the session on indicators and development. It became pretty clear yesterday that there's a need for accountability both in the construction and use of indicators, so I'm particularly interested in today's papers which fulfill some of that function. And we will start with a presentation by Kevin Davis, who is the Bella Family Professor of Business Law and the Vice Dean responsible for Global and International Affairs at New York University, who will share his insights on legal indicators with us. Just to say that it would be great if all the presenters would stick to 10 minutes, because we have quite a full session to make sure that there's also some room for discussion and interaction later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christiane. So the paper that I sent for the conference focuses on a very narrow topic within the broad frame of the theme of this conference. Because the definition of the scope of the conference is actually somewhat ambiguous. It seemed to me there are at least three different ways of talking about the relationship between indicators and law. So the first is to think of the indicators as being a form of law or as being similar to law. And I think a number of the papers have proceeded in that vein. The second way is to talk about the law of indicators and how to regulate them and so forth. And of course, yesterday we had a number of discussions about that topic. But I think that a lot of the papers, at least in this session today, will focus on a third interpretation of the theme of the conference, which is indicators of law. So how do we go about measuring law, and what are the particular challenges and opportunities that are presented when we try to use indicators to capture what's important about a legal system? And so my paper is very much in that vein, and here I'm going to focus on a particular type of indicator of law, what I call a standardized legal indicator, and talk about, for the bulk of my presentation, some of the limitations of these standardized legal indicators when they're used in a particular way. So that's the idea. But at the very end, hopefully, I will be able to say something that's of somewhat broader interest, because I'd like to spend at least a minute or so talking about the alternatives to my standard, what I'm calling standardized indicators, and in fact alternatives to indicators altogether, because that's a topic that hasn't really been put on the table so far at the conference. We've all been focused in a very productive way on what are indicators, what are the dangers, opportunities, and so forth, but I think it's worth stepping back and thinking about, well, what else is there besides indicators? If we want to move away from them, well, what directions could we go in? So, first of all, the paper itself. What I mean by a standardized indicator is one that collects data in a standardized way, right, and simplifies data in a standardized way. So all indicators simplify a more complex body of information, and to some extent they all standardize by representing the information in a standardized way. But I'm interested in indicators that simplify in a standardized way. So they go to every country and say these parts of this information about the legal system is relevant and this other information is not. So this information is going to be included and presented to the world. This other part of the information about the legal system is going to be excluded. And then I'm particularly interested in how those indicators can be used for what I think of as the scientific purpose of trying to understand the relationship between law and development. Okay. So what do I mean in more concrete terms? I'll just resort to my favorite example, the doing business indicators. They're very convenient for these purposes. As most of you will be aware, one of the things they do is to collect data and simplify information about how easy it is to do business in various ways, including, for example, to enforce contracts. So they'll present a hypothetical situation to lawyers in a particular country, and they'll ask them, how many days does it take to enforce a contract in this case? How much does it cost? How many steps are involved? Right? And the indicator is just that information. So they also, to be fair, require them to send in a narrative describing the process, but then the indicator itself simplifies that narrative into just a handful of numbers. Okay? So I think there are at least three distinct problems with using that kind of indicator that standardizes, that just picks out the same type of information about this process of enforcing a judgment from every country around the world. So first of all, if we're using it for the purpose of understanding whether that legal system is going to promote development, we have to take into account the fact that different users might have different conceptions of development. So if you care just about judicial efficiency and speed and so forth, then this indicator might work for you. But if you care about due process, and that's part of your conception of development, then this indicator is actually going to be excluding relevant information. So that's one limitation of this sort of standardized process, that it might not accommodate variations in conceptions of development. A second limitation is that in different legal systems, different processes might be used to accomplish the same functional ends. So again, a standard example is in some jurisdictions, the way you enforce a contract, the principal way, or to collect on a debt, would be to go through the civil process. But in other jurisdictions, you might use criminal proceedings. You might ask people to give you post-dated checks and then initiate criminal proceedings against people who fail to make good on the checks. And when you're dealing with a legal system like that, information about the efficacy of the criminal proceeding might be more relevant than information about the efficacy of the civil proceeding. So that's another way in which the standardized indicator might not capture everything that's relevant about a particular system. And then in the final way is when it fails to capture information about complements to the legal instruments that it actually measures. So if it fails to capture, for instance, information about how easy it is to find lawyers to help you prosecute your civil claim, it may actually misrepresent or provide at least misleading information about how many days it takes to and how difficult it is to bring a civil action. So if you ask about the cost of a civil action in a particular country without also asking about the cost of the legal fees that everyone will have to incur to bring that action, you're missing an important part of reality. So that's the sort of essence of the paper that I presented to suggest that there is this inherent limitation in any indicator that standardizes the data collection process in this particular way, if you're planning to use it to understand the relationship between law and development. Now, there are at least two ways we can try to respond to this problem to the extent we think it's a problem. One is to abandon standardization, right? To try to use indicators, retain the use of indicators, but use non-standardized indicators. So you could ask your respondents, instead of how many days does it take to use a civil proceeding to the civil process to enforce this contract, you could just ask them, how easy is it to enforce the contract in this hypothetical scenario? Or how much would it cost? Without asking for the details, without being very specific. Or just how well does your system respond to this type of case, if you want to make sure they capture different normative criteria, that they apply their own criteria, right? So there are ways of addressing this problem by reducing the extent of the standardization in the data collection process, and there are some obvious dangers in doing that as well. You lose some of the cross-country comparability that many people have said is an important or useful feature of indicators. So that's one possible response. The other response, I think, is potentially more interesting for the purposes of today's discussion, which is to abandon the simplification. Right? So I said that these standardized indicators simplify in a standardized way. One way to get around the problem is to abandon the standardization. The other way is to abandon the simplification. If we do that, then we're moving, I think, outside the realm of indicators, because at least the way I and my collaborators have defined them, indicators necessarily simplify. Right? And they simplify for good reasons. Right? Those reasons typically are that the simplification reduces the costs of collecting the data. Right? You're not asking people to explain everything about the legal system of their country, just how it applies to one hypothetical scenario and one aspect of the process. And it also reduces the cost of processing the data, which is very difficult once you get past having more than two countries to deal with. Right? So there are very good reasons to hang on to this idea that we need to have a mechanism for simplifying the more complex reality that's out there, all the complexity of real-life legal systems. But if only to be provocative, I'd like to suggest that those reasons are not always they're not always going to be completely overriding, right? There will be situations in which it's not actually that costly to collect data on everything. This is increasingly the case as legal processes and legal transactions are computerized, right? The computers collect data on every case that enters many court systems automatically. So in many jurisdictions now, the data is there. It's not like you'll have to send someone out to transcribe handwritten pleadings or typed pleadings and to find carbon copies and so forth. In many cases, something has been entered in the docket in electronic form, and the raw data is actually there waiting to be mined. So it's not clear that the concerns about the cost of data collection should necessarily be an impediment to to abandoning simplification and instead resorting to raw data. Similarly, the costs of processing data have obviously declined dramatically over the past few years. It's now commonplace for scientists in a range of domains to work with enormous data sets that, say, use data on all the cell phone calls placed by people over a six-month period in a particular city to figure out social networks. This is something that social scientists and natural scientists do all the time. In the natural sciences, when they're processing information about the human genome, they're actually using massive amounts of data, working with massive amounts of data, and I suspect that legal scholars, policy analysts could actually start to do some of the same things with legal data that I think is increasingly being available. So the other approach, the other way to get around the limitations of these standardized indicators, I think, is to abandon the concept of indicators altogether and start to do more work with raw data. And so in the actual example I'm using here, instead of relying on data about hypothetical cases that involve debt collection, why not make a greater effort to use the data that's out there about actual cases where people have tried to collect their debts in a range of fact patterns and look for those, try to figure out what data makes sense in any given country in any given context. So that's the gist of the paper, including the provocation at the end that perhaps we can at some point get beyond indicators and use the advances in information processing technology to help us do that. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. I pass now the word to Maria Angelica Prada from the Universidad de los Andes in Bogota, who's going to share her insights on the use of the World Bank performance indicators, what impact they have on development in the Global South.
So, good morning. The paper I presented for this conference is actually, although it is a case study of the bank's performance indicator by the International Development Association, it also tries to give a broader framework of the use of indicator in the field of development cooperation. So what I suggest in the paper is that there has been in the last decades there has been an increase in the use of indicators in the development field for two main reasons. The first one is the increase in the existence of the need in the existence of quantifiable goals such as the Millennium Development Goals. And in the second place, because of what I call an effectiveness complex, and is the necessity in the development field to measure the effectiveness of development and the effectiveness of development aid. So for these two reasons, the use of indicators has increased, and it has increased in two ways, in the measurement of effectiveness of aid and state performance towards development, and in the second place, which is a newer use of the indicators, the use of this technology to allocate aid, which is the case of the performance-based indicator of the IDA. Now, what I think indicators are important in the development field is because they have two effects which have already been discussed by several of the other papers presented here. The first one is they have a knowledge effect, and that is actually the focus of my paper. So they produce knowledge. And how do they produce knowledge? They produce knowledge by determining what constitutes development. And the idea of development is highly contested, even within institutions such as the World Bank, where contesting theories of development are struggling to determine the model of development, which has to be followed by states in the South. And the second way in which it creates knowledge is because these theories of development that lie behind the indicators actually have embedded categories in it. So this dichotomy between developed and underdeveloped are embedded in the notion of development that is being promoted by different indicators. So what I suggest is that when an actor in the development field uses a specific indicator, it is either it is effectively promoting a determined theory of development, of how development should be achieved and how development should be understood. And this, in turn, affects the governance effect of indicators, since it produces an incentive, whether it is an economic incentive, as it is the case of the IDA, or just an incentive on reputation for the states that want to be considered as developed states. So the struggle for the determination of the notion of development has made the theory or the theorization of development more complex. So nowadays there are several theories of development that want to include notions of human rights, economic performance. And I suggest that when analyzing the genealogy of an indicator, you can actually see in its modification how the theory, the underneath theory of development, is also being modified. And you can see this, and that's one of the reasons why I chose the performance indicator of the IDI, because it is an indicator that started to be used in the 1970s and has been radically changed ever since. So in the 1980s, if you see in the presentation, there were three elements which were taken into account. I just forgot to say, the performance-based allocation system is used by the IDA to rank states and to allocate aid dependent of this rating. So the better the rating, the more aid you receive. That's the idea behind this indicator. So in the 1980s, it was a more simple indicator. It took into account national poverty measured through income per capita, credit worthiness of the state, and the economic performance measured through macroeconomic indicators such as growth and saving rates, which actually relates to the theories of development that were being promoted by the World Bank at the time, which are called in the development field as modernization theories, which were based on the idea that development was achieved through macroeconomic policies. National poverty measure through income per capita and the credit worthiness is still taken into account, not in the indicator in itself, but more to determine which states are eligible to be IDA borrowers. In the 1980s, it had one of its first changes, so it included other elements, the short-term economic management and the long-term economic management, more or less the management that the state had on the market, and it included a new element, which was the poverty reduction policies, and this to the delivery of social service, and this also relates to the shift the World Bank was having at the time towards a theory that wanted to include basic needs elements in the idea of what constitutes development. Finally, the biggest change in the indicator came in 1998, And it was divided in four clusters. So the economic management, the structural policies, policies for social inclusion and equity, and finally the public sector management and the institutions. And in turn, this one's divided in 16 elements. So the 16 elements you see were not the ones from 1998. At the time, there were 20 elements, but for the time being, I'm just presenting the ones that are used nowadays. So this is how the indicator is calculated. The country performance rating includes the country performance institutional assessment, which includes these four clusters, is 92% of the indicator. Then there is an 8% of the portfolio performance rating. And in 2004, two more elements were included because there was a debate that regarding the bias of these indicators against really small states. So the bank decided to include also the country needs through population and GNI per capita and the based allocation, which, okay. So I just want to show you how complex the indicator has become. And that is something that is happening with development indicators. The more complex the theory of development is, the more complex the indicator becomes, or the more indicators are needed to assess development. For example, the Millennium Development Goals are 8 goals, but the United Nations had to create 60 indicators to produce the proxies to measure those 8 goals. So this actually shows how the theory, there is always a theory of development behind the indicator, and how the use of indicators becomes more complex, the more complex the theory is. Now, in the paper, I present a framework to understand the theories of development behind indicators, which I'm almost out of time, so I won't talk about that much. But more or less, I propose that there are three frames: economic-based approach, institutional-based approach, and rights-based approach. Now, this is, again, the CPIA, which is the 98% of the indicator, so the most important part. And the World Bank has said that that this indicator is actually showing a shift toward good governance, which I will qualify as an institutional-based approach. But if you see the elements in blue, they actually still reflect economic concerns from institutional economics and what has been called the Washington Consensus concerns. So it actually shows that the bank is not really shifting its theory of development, even though in the discourse it is. And however, it is important that in cluster C, it has included new concerns, although they're not much taken into account because of the percentage that is given to them, which are gender concerns, social protection. Well, you see there are 5 concerns. So to sum up, what I propose in the paper is that this knowledge effect, which is determining, is actually a problem of representation of what constitutes development and what the categories of actors in development is, produces it as well as an effect in governance, since it sends an incentive to the developing states regarding the theory or the policy of development that they have to pursue to achieve this category of developed. So that will be all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Maria. I pass now the floor to Michael Wiegner, who's at the Justus Liebig University and at the moment as well at the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg, to tell us a bit more about the World Bank's country policy and institutional assessment.
Well, thank you very much and good morning to everyone. I'm grateful to present to you today an extract from my larger PhD project in which I address the relationship between international institutional law and knowledge governance in development organizations. Today's paper illustrates my general approach, which can be applied to other indicators as well, but I use today the example of the country policy and institutional assessment, the CPIA, which is the good governance indicator used by the World Bank for performance-based allocation and for influencing development policy. My presentation is structured in 4 parts. Part 1 sets out my methodological approach and my main argument. Part two sets out an analytical framework for indicators. Part three applies this framework to the CPIA and analyzes the existing legal framework. And part four evaluates this existing regime against general principles of development cooperation law. You can follow the structure on the handout I handed out. Now, my own take on indicators differs from that of the other panelists here in that I look at the CPIA as an object of legal regulation. That is, I inquire what the existing legal rules and principles already say about its production and its use. Now, in that sense, and for the purpose of this presentation, I take it for granted that the CPIA is a powerful knowledge and governance instrument. And I also take it for granted that indicators which measure the institutional determinants of development have methodological limitations. What I'm concerned with is how international institutional law, and in particular the administrative law of the World Bank, addresses these concerns of development, of effectiveness, and of legitimacy. So my main argument is the following. The CPIA is a promising tool to make development more effective, but it requires an appropriate public law framework to address these effectiveness and legitimacy concerns. This framework already exists within the law of development cooperation, at least in part, but it must be developed further according to the general principles of that field of law. Now, with this, I come to part two of the presentation, where I first draw from the existing literature on governance by information to argue that the CPIA is a legally relevant exercise of international public authority. In the next step, I then submit that the existing law of development cooperation already captures indicators with a double lens. Firstly, inasmuch as indicators affect aid allocation, they come into the purview of what has been conceptualized already as the administrative law of development cooperation. That is the body of rules and principles that govern the allocation of official development aid. Secondly, I argue that this same body of law can also be reconstructed as regulating the generation and the use of knowledge in development administration, including indicators. Now, in the third part of the paper, I apply this perspective and analyze in how far the CPIA is already regulated by development law. In this regard, a first look reveals two things. First, that the distributive consequences for aid allocation, as illustrated by Maria's paper, are based on formal bank law enacted by organs representing member states. Secondly, that the content of the assessment criteria, that is the concept of good governance and development, is produced in a purely informal manner by bank management alone. So the upshot of this is that the CPI has empowered a more or less independent international bureaucracy to define standards of good governance and to exercise considerable public authority over borrowing member states. This finding prompts a second look at the rules, and namely the rules that govern participation, transparency, and review in the CPI process. These findings can be summarized as follows. Firstly, borrowing member states that are subjected to the CPIA have very limited formal participation rights in the CPIA process. Secondly, transparency has increased considerably over time and is now legally regulated in the bank's access to information policy, with some remaining gaps. Finally, there is no judicial review proper of the CPIA, but only a non-legal review by the bank's independent evaluation group. In sum, there thus exists a legal framework, but the question obviously is whether this existing regime is adequate, a question which I address in the fourth and last part of the paper. Now, the legal evaluation needs a legal yardstick for the assessment, and the yardstick of my evaluation is formed by four principles of development cooperation law. They are development, orientation, efficacy, as well as collective and individual autonomy. These principles are derived from the existing sources of international law, and they help structure criticism, they provide an evaluative standard, and they guide the interpretation of the existing legal rules. So these principles are very much at the heart of my approach to indicators, and I would love to talk about them more, but I can't, so I will limit myself to three remarks here. The first is that the use of indicators like the CPA may well contribute to the fulfillment of these legal principles, because they can make development cooperation more evidence-based, more rules-based, more transparent, and less politicized. That contributes namely to development orientation, which requires donors and recipients to orient aids towards the autonomous aim of poverty reduction, and not to heteronomous aims of donor interests, for instance. It also may contribute to efficacy, because efficacy requires donors and recipients to do so in a manner that is cost-effective, results-oriented, and coherent. And empirical evidence suggests that politically driven aid may be less effective. Now, however, it is, of course, by no means sure that the bank management will always get the indicators right. To the contrary, there is ample evidence that the production of scientific knowledge in large hierarchical bureaucracies suffers from pathologies that may be detrimental to the development orientation and efficacy of their work. Hence, and this is the second remark, to counter these pathologies, the same two principles may require the bank to optimize or to reinterpret the organizational rules applicable to the production and use of indicators, namely the rules regarding transparency and review. To illustrate this remark with an example regarding transparency, there's a problem in the bank's access to information policy in that it only requires the publication of the CPI criteria and the IDA ratings for borrowers, but not of the written justification for individual ratings. That means that the reliability of these individual ratings cannot be independently verified. The solution for this might be, and this is a legal solution, that the principles of development and efficacy may require the bank to reinterpret the policy and to use an otherwise discretionary exception clause to disclose also the written justification for the individual ratings. Now, the third and last remark regarding the principles concerns collective autonomy, which is a sector-specific reformulation of the sovereignty principle and the principle of non-intervention, and namely protects recipients' ownership of their own development process. With regard to the CPA, this can mean three things at least. Firstly, it may limit the content of the indicator criteria to what is allowed by the non-political mandate enshrined in the bank's founding treaty, which is an expression of collective autonomy and sovereignty. Secondly, collective autonomy may be taken to call for increased participation of the borrowers in the making of the CPIA. This would support claims made elsewhere that organs representing member states should always decide on indicator criteria. This can be discussed later. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a bit skeptical in this regard, because in case of the World Bank, this proposal would mean that it might just enhance donor domination of the whole process due to weighted voting in the organs representing member states, and there may also be trade-offs with development orientation and efficacy. Now, where the collective autonomy deploys its strongest effect, in my opinion, is when it comes to the consequences of the CPIA. These consequences should indeed be limited to the inter-country allocation of aid, which is what the law explicitly says. They should possibly not govern the subsequent operations and policymaking on the country level, which are subject to recipient ownership and democratic politics. So with this, I conclude, and I hope we will have some time to discuss this principles approach to indicators, and maybe also how this handles the potential tensions between democratic politics on the one hand and technocratic instruments like indicators on the other. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I pass now the floor to Gabi Umbach, who is the director of the Globalization Database Project of the European University Institute in Florence, to comment on the papers.
Thank you very much, Christiane. And thanks to the organizers to allow me to participate in such an interesting conference that is focused on framing a legal idea and on developing a research field that so far, as I understand it from my disciplinary perspective, as a political scientist, is not so much research. So it's very interesting to see where we do have common fields of interest, but where we also do have non-so-common and maybe problematic and pitfalls in the terms and language we use. And therefore allow me maybe to exploit a bit this disciplinary perspective to offer you a bit of an insight into what we understand under indicators, what is interesting for us, and maybe what can also inform your development of the research field in a way, as I hope. So if we take a political science point of view, indicators are embedded in this field of post-regulatory, beyond-the-state governance elements. So we are in the field of modes of governance that are complementing legislation, rulemaking by the state. We're very much, and that's what we saw yesterday and today as well, in the field of participation, delegation, transparency. So how we, by ideational change and convergence, impact on different parts of the political process, and how we, by policy diffusion, institutional isomorphism, via soft modes of governance, might impact beyond legislation on how idea of certain policy areas are framed. So we are within the field of governance beyond the state, which might give you an idea, or which might create the question whether some sort of need for legislation beyond law is necessary now from a legal point of view, because we enter an area which is a bit blurry and where legal concepts maybe come to a certain, face some gaps in approaching the area. So indicators have been analyzed very much in the context of the EU. In political science, in the framework of the open method of coordination yesterday, the Stability and Growth Pact, the Fiscal Pact was mentioned, in hard and soft modes of governance that are not legislation, but that impact on member states' development. And all these ization processes, so Europeanization, globalization, all have different impacts on different areas. They impact on policy, on content, on politics, so on the processes, but they also impact on the polity, so the institutions as such. And they do have different mechanisms, given that indicators target at different elements. They target sometimes at performance, sometimes at the outcome, sometimes at the output, at procedures, at structural elements of a given process they want to impact. So you see that you do have different incentives for policy transfer, and you also have different modes how they impact on convergence, on potential convergence. That could be convergence towards a benchmark, convergence in between the countries towards a certain model, ideational-wise, and different elements that steer this convergence, integration, emulation, things like that. So you don't have just the indicator. And what was a bit, what was interesting for me yesterday to see that, and today not so much because it's very much focused thematically, but yesterday it was interesting to see that the language seems to conflict a bit when we talk about indicators, indices, and composite indicators, because these are different things to me. An indicator is more child mortality, employment, which in itself is not necessarily normative. Set of indicators is a consensus at a given, so it's a snapshot, it's a consensus in a given time of a certain field, and there we come very much close to what Maria is working on, to see that we do have a development consensus which changes over time, which leads me to an interesting thing to say, okay, indicators are created to be flexible in a way. How can legal theory, how can the legalization of these indicators integrate this flexibility? So how to open up the way for further development of the indicators? Isn't a further legalization of indicators already a break in the idea of an indicator to steer a certain process and to steer a certain idea, but to be open to changes over time? So these are the maybe general remarks on the research subject, which is very flux, which is flexible, and which, given that indicators now come to the public and that they were in some cases originally invented to be internal, inner institutional measurement units rather than something to present to the public to steer a certain idea and view of a policy area. It of course now enters the area where it's becoming legally relevant, and that's why it's very interesting to me to participate. Now I might go a bit into the single papers, and it's thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the different papers, all the three of them together, because they are really, if you read them together, it's different steps on the way to understanding the field. While Kevin develops on the overall theoretical frame, Maria, it's the empirical evidence of the development in a field, and Michael then goes more into the conceptual elements that frame the field. So a very interesting collection of papers within this session. As to Kevin, basically now your presentation, it became a bit more clear to me, but one of the main questions when reading your paper was, what is the legal substance of a legal standardized indicator? Is it a legal principle? Is it an idea that we have? Or is it law? Because when you talk about the misfit of legal universalism to explain indicators and to formulate binding or valid indicators across systems, then it comes a bit to my mind that the substance is law then, rather than a principle, which you could agree on, rather, a legal principle. So is law equals law legal indicator? Or is it more the idea behind the law, the legal principle, that is the legal standardized indicator? So would opting for broader concepts of a legal indicator be a way out of the problem of missing validity across systems? Or would, as we call it, integrate intervening variables, because what you describe as the misfit, so as the missing element to make the indicator valid across systems, is systematic elements. As you say, some societies have different views on development, have different views on how to tackle unemployment, for example. This is often a political and a governmental view. So if we integrate in a legal theory about indicators, about legal indicators, a categorization and a further differentiation according to political systems, does this help to formulate more valid legal indicators across systemic borders in a first place, to then extract patterns of legal indicators across the systems for a more overarching theory? This is an interesting point for me to see. So are there constitutional elements that bring forward a validity of legal indicators in some contexts, while it doesn't in others? And does this inform a global legal theory on indicators? Another point is that with the economic area, and you very much referred to the doing business indicators, with the economic area, you do have a very contested case study, where of course countries are very much interested in responding to indicators, while maybe in other areas, like human rights, for example, the naming, blaming, shaming element of the global level is rather weak, and governments do not tend to respond. So it would be very interesting to see if this missing validity of legal universalism arguments holds true if we compare it to other policy areas. And would this be an option to further amend this theoretical approach, to not go for instruments across areas, but to see what legal instruments work in what policy areas? Another thing, but that's what Michael's paper responded to, is how close are they to soft law? Excuse me. Uh, So how close are these indicators to soft law? And another thing that you now said in your presentation, it might help to work with raw data. What do you exactly mean by that? How would the legal methodology look like working with more raw data? Would this really mean you go into one indicator and see how this, and I really mean indicator, not set of indicators, how this is then anchored in the material, in the data? These would be, for me, interesting things to learn more about within your paper. Now, the paper Maria presented very much focused on a contested area, so it's not just a paradigm that is framed on global level, but it's not just about the distribution of funds. If we take it a bit sarcastic to an end, it's about lives. So what is developed as a theory impacts on the people on the ground, meaning that if in the World Bank a certain indicator frames what country gets money, ex negativo, this means that certain countries are totally left behind with the financing. So we have to be sure about and clear about that the development area is a very, very vital thing in international politics. So it's not just about donor countries exposing themselves with financial funds as good players. It's about lives. So this as a footnote, maybe. What Maria very much focus on is this change of paradigm, and you integrated this knowledge and governance effect. I already said that is anchored in our discipline in the epistemic community elements, paradigms, ideational convergence, policy diffusion. Sometimes, and you strongly focus on these autonomy concerns of the recipient side. So how can we integrate recipient countries to frame the field as well? In the paper, sometimes it reads a bit, not negative, but one could get the idea that it's negative to monitor the allocation of aid, in a way. That was a bit the idea I got from the paper. So I would be interested in your view, why should, apart from leaving the weakest behind, why should a performance-based allocation of aid, of development aid, be negative in itself? There are elements of the collective autonomy element come in, concerns come in. Why should not donors who are responsible to their taxpayers have a say in how and where money is allocated to? This is an ideational point. Could bringing in more human development elements, capability elements, be a way out of this very economic focused structural predominance of allocation of aid? So what the UN in itself with the Human Development Reports and Indices did, could this be a way forward also for the World Bank within its indicators? And if so, don't also the donor states have to rethink their focus on GDP growth? And don't we have to really focus our discussion worldwide on a beyond GDP approach to human development as a paradigmatic change here? And can legal elements grasp this? So is a focus refocusing on human rights and human rights to access, to equity, things like that, an approach for law to go forward here? On Michael's paper, and I read it in the direction it was outlined, it's outlined in the program, and Michael's paper very much gave to me an idea of, wow, yeah, that's why, responding to yesterday, so what question. It very much and very excellently, in my view, summarizes, conceptualizes why indicators are important for law and for legal experts. So thank you very much for this, in my view, very excellent conceptualization of things. Apart from having understood why indicators interfere with the global administrative law and where it's important. It would be interesting in the discussion for me to learn more about this problem about autonomy concerns, collective autonomy as a concept to evade this, and how you think this could be elaborated in terms of process and content elements to further develop the field. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gabby. I take two questions from the floor and then give the opportunity to the speakers to react to the questions before moving on. Are there any questions at this stage to the presenters? Mm-hmm. One here and one here. Okay.
Thank you. In the paper presented, I got the impression that they assume that the indicators are used as the unique instrument to measure and to take decisions. Actually, in my experience, this is not the case. The European Commission, for example, uses a lot of indicators, but they are usually complemented with other formal and informal instruments. And these really mitigate the role and the importance of indicators. I was wondering if it's the same with the indicators which has been mentioned in those papers. Thank you.
Thank you. Sabino Cassese, please.
I have a comment which takes together three points made. One by Kevin, the three problems on standardized legal indicators. One by Michael, tension between democracy, democratic policy and technocracy. And the third one by Maria on the embedded conceptions of development. Now, let me state again the problem. I think that our problem is that indicators are a very powerful exercise of global public authority. They are a powerful instrument, as powerful as armies. Think of the French reaction to the doing business affair. The French side, they reacted to the doing business indicators by saying that this is putting too much emphasis on common law against civil law because there is a bias in using those indicators. So this is a kind of war. So I ask myself how to address this problem, and I want to ask Kevin, are the responses to your question only two, abandon standardization, abandon simplification, or should we think of two more reactions? One is multiply indicators, collecting more indicators, as indicators are mainly the product of closed epistemic communities, bureaucracies. Why not having more indicators? So pluralism, introducing pluralism in indicators. This is one. And second, why don't we consider this point made by Michael, the possibility to introduce some more fairness in the process of producing indicators. If, as Maria pointed out, the indicators are the product of ideologies or conceptions, why not adding a dialogue in the process of producing those indicators? In other words, if indicators are part of the regulatory process, why not submitting indicators production to some procedural requirements in order to make the indicators production proceeding more fair, so that we can, I mean, is more open. I mean, it's a pity that Giulio Tremonti is not here, because he told me yesterday A few things about, you know, he was a treasury minister for a long time, and he had to fight the rating agencies. And he told me a few things about how rating agencies proceed, how many political bias are inside the rating procedures. So make open the process and the criteria by which rating agencies or indicators production is done. That's all.
Thank you very much. Any presenters would like to react? Okay, maybe we just start in the order of the presentations. Kevin?
So thanks, and thank you, Gabi, for the comments in particular. I won't respond to Julia because my focus was not on indicators used for decision-making purposes, so I'll leave that topic for the present. I think actually I really only raised one problem with these standardized indicators. In its essence, there's really only one problem, that they don't capture enough data. Right? That's at the core of what I was saying. And when I said that there are two responses, that's also making it too complicated. Really, there's one response, to collect more data, right? And then there are different ways in which you could go about collecting more data, which I think map on to the suggestions that both Gabi and Sabino have raised. So you can collect more data in this sort of ad hoc way. You can say, well, you can ask people to talk about enforcement efficiency, talk about that legal principle, say, as opposed to the laws of civil procedure. I think that's what you're getting at. It's a broader principle. And then they will bring in more data than what would be required in a form that says, report on your law of civil procedure. So that's one approach. The other way is just to collect as much data as possible, right? And the ultimate limit of that approach is to work with what I'm calling the raw data. Right, but there are steps along the way. You could say, well, at least collect more intermediate variables, data on more of the intermediate variables, or on the constitutional context. But this is all moving in the same direction towards collecting more data, or multiply indicators, just collect data still in the form of indicators, but multiply the indicators. Yes, so I think all of those suggestions are consistent with the bottom line. I just, for the sake of being provocative, I proposed what I thought as the ultimate, as a limit of this approach, which is to just collect all of the data and then try to allow people to mine it for whatever purposes they choose. So I think I'll take these as friendly comments and suggest that they're in the spirit of what I was proposing.
Maria?
I would like to make 3 points regarding the comments that were made first by Gabi and by Sabino. So when I reread my paper, because this is a small version of a larger paper, so I was worried that it would come across as if I was saying, so the economic approach to development is wrong. And I think that's not the idea of the paper. It's just to show that there are different approaches and contesting theories that are underneath this development indicators that may be used as if they were universal. And ideologically, I will say, yes, the best thing will be to increase human rights concerns, but that's still imposing a theory of development in which I believe, because I have that ideology. So it is the same as if an economist was promoting an economic approach. It is imposing a theory through an instrument through a technology of governance. And I think I only suggested this barely in this shorter version of the paper. I think there are two main problems in the use of indicators in development, and these are the allocation of responsibility of development failure and the problem of ownership that was being mentioned by Michael. And I do think that the solution is not just to say, okay, let's include human rights or let's include economic approaches, but to, as Sabino says, to create a dialogue and a pluralism. And the CPIA, which Michael and I presented has a lack in participation of states, and especially receiving states, in its production. So I do think the more important part of the use of indicators in development is that it should create more more spaces for participation. However, this also raises the question, should states participate or should also the civil society participate? So where should we allocate the responsibility? Or should we also allocate the responsibility in the international organization? Are they also responsible for the failure? Should that also be discussed in the production of this indicator? Should the indicator also be used to measure not only the state's performance, but the organization performance? So I think it's really complicated, and all those things should be taken into account to answer these two points. And regarding the point on whether it isn't the unique instrument used, what I found in my research in development cooperation is that indicators they're used, and when they're used, they're important, but yes, they're not always used, and most decisions are still taken because of political reasons. So I actually think the move towards indicators is good. A decision taken through an indicator is always better than a decision taken just in arbitrariness or political reasons. So yeah, that will be all.
Thank you. Michael?
Thanks. I have two remarks. One regards the principles and legal positivism and its role in indicators, and the second, the more general issue of scientific knowledge versus politics. On the one hand, my approach is very positivist because I think that there are legal rules that indicators need to abide by, and that lawyers are the only discipline that is trained to apply that. And I think that there are already legal issues, for instance, in the transparency area, and laws that are not being abided by. Like, the World Bank does not publish the guidance note underlying the CPIA, and that goes for other indicators as well. So who, if not lawyers, should point out these failures and apply it? And they know it. I did interviews with the World Bank staff, and they said, well, we're not publishing it because no one asks us, and because we know that it's not that good already, so we better wait. So this is, I think, a very obvious role of lawyers. It may be boring because it's positivism, but there's no one else to do it. What is more exciting, maybe, is the general question how does scientific knowledge and indicators are expression of scientific knowledge relate to political self-determination. And that's what I very much wanted to make clear with the principles approach. And here, of course, collective autonomy comes in two ways, maybe. The one is that, of course, the law that as it exists takes account of these self-determination politics problems in various ways, by limiting the content of the indicator criteria, for instance. That goes not only with regard to the mandate of what the World Bank is allowed to actually include in terms of considerations, but also when it comes to development. There's one argument in the paper that the bank needs to abide by its own definition of development that has been agreed on among the organs of the organization. And individual autonomy, which is human rights, which I left out of the paper, may also have limits there when it comes to ILO conventions, for instance, that might conflict with what the CPIA contains. So that's another issue that goes to the heart of what is political about this and where the law helps us to bring in politics. The more maybe even political, philosophical question is, in how far does scientific knowledge tell us what to do in the state, in the politics, and what role does there remain for politics if science has already all the obvious solutions? Is that fire? No. So in this regard, there's two options when it comes to your dialogue. So, shall we continue, or? Okay. So you can have a dialogue within science. That would mean you politicize science. You have rules that require scientists to abide by transparency and, you know, consensus-finding rules that we know from politics. The other thing is you can scientize politics, require politicians to take into account these scientific indicators. And I'm not sure about other countries, but we've had this debate in Germany, I think even in the 60s, about technocracy, and Jürgen Habermas made a proposal there that distinguished between decisionistic decision-making, and this goes to your question, decisionistic decision-making, on the one hand that's purely politics, technocratic, that it's purely science, and one that he calls pragmatistic, where you have certain redundancies whereby you engage into a dialogue between politics and scientists, and in the end you end up with some more rational solution. And I think that is still a very valid approach, and if we could turn that into legal rules applying to indicators, that would make a lot of sense. And in a way, that is what happens in many ways. In the World Bank CPIA, I don't think it is, because there's a formula that is really an automatic decision on who gets how much aid. So in that sense, I think this might be different, and it might be different in the case of the World Bank to the European Union. And I think we should approach that to a more pragmatistic model.
Thank you, Michael. We will now move on to the second part of the session. Again, it would be great if the speakers also can stick to the 10 minutes, because I'm sure there are a lot of burning questions from the floor on their papers that they would like to ask you. So I will pass. It's my pleasure to pass the floor to David Hofizi and Araya Araya. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing your names correctly, from the Loyola University in Chicago, to tell us more about the assessment that they have been doing of the investing across borders indicators.
Thank you very much. Well, this paper is inspired by one of the courses that we took in our course, in our program, this, which is LLM in Rule of Law for Development, which is hosted by Loyola University Chicago, based in Rome. Yeah, we'd like to thank first Sarah Dadouche, because it was because of her guidance that we developed the paper, so we appreciate that. Thank you. Well, the problem that we're going to deal with is that if this investing across borders has something to do with land grabbing or with this cross-border land investment deals, or if they can contribute to the positive development of this investment. Well, this investing across borders, they are produced by the World Bank Group and complementing to the Doing Business Index. They focus on the foreign-owned companies, and they do evaluate the legal, administrative, regulatory, and initial impediments for foreign direct investment. And they focus on the foreign owned companies, while the Doing Business Index focus on the evaluation of the government's regulatory framework and its efforts, but for domestically owned companies. So we'll be focusing on the investing across borders, or I would call them IAB. And I would like to select one of the most pertinent points, which is the about accessing industrial land. This accessing industrial land part of the investing across borders indicators evaluates the domestic regulatory framework to assess how easy or how complicated it is for a foreign investor to lease or to own land. And they measure the strength of lease rights and the strength of ownership rights, among other things. This strength is based on two elements. The first one is that if there is equal treatment of foreign investors and local investors. And the second point is the ability to engage in, for the foreign investor to engage in additional transactions related to the land, such as subleasing of the land, subdividing it, mortgaging it, or leveraging the land as collateral. Well, however, a country will get more points if its legislation gives preferential treatment to the foreign investor, or it favors foreign investor. For example, if the investor can transfer the land or can transfer the lease, and even the country gets more points if its legislation allows for the leasing of the land to another foreign investor, while it doesn't penalize if it doesn't do so. Well, these indicators In principle, they seek to assist the stimulation of economic growth by giving primacy to this foreign direct investment as a driver for five things. The first one is the creation of jobs, the transfer of technology, upgrading of skills, fostering of competition, and generally the overall contribution to the fiscal standing of the economies. These IAB indicators, they were developed, maybe I don't know if there is any connection with that, but they were developed contemporaneously with when there was an increase in cross-border land investment deals in the global south, or specifically Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Well, some of these investments are really beneficial and they do increase the FDI and they create opportunities for development. And what are the benefits that we'll see in this? By the way, we are deliberately ignoring the outline because we have to readjust our time. But let me take your attention to the benefits that a country can get because of this investment. There could be tax revenues or infrastructure development, which is in addition to the fees that the country collects from these investors, and modernization of rural areas and transfer of technology and employment creation and transfer of expertise. In this aspect, this investment can be considered as development finance, which is positive. However, some of these investments really highly affect the communities and women's and other vulnerable groups' rights, even pastoralists. And so there are some traits that we can also see in this investment, which are like some of them, the loss of livelihoods, low and irregular wage payments, displacement of populations, perpetuation of food insecurity, already food insecure countries, mainly in Africa, and resistance to land reform. In that aspect, much of the investment is called as land grabbing. Well, this investing across borders, the indicators, they treat the social and environmental impact, which are the threats of this investment. They treat the social and environmental impact assessment and tracking as only optional, and they don't oblige the country to fulfill these requirements, and rather as they are not essential in achieving the optimal benefit to the country. So from this IRB investing across borders perspective, they are not really very important values, and accordingly a country will not be penalized for not fulfilling such obligations, this social and environmental impact. Well, are these IAB indicators at odds with the social and environmental norms, at odds with that? Well, my colleague David will try to see if there is any inconsistency within the World Bank policies, and try to see in general with the development architecture. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I'll take over from there. I think it's important for me to start by highlighting that the IAB indicators themselves state as part of their objective that they not only seek to promote behaviors or business practices that do not overburden investors, but they also seek to encourage countries to have social and environmental protection. This is part of the objective. However, as my colleague has pointed out, we looked at the investing across sectors and accessing industrial land categories of the IAB indicators. It's under four categories. We looked at those two as those relevant to cross-border land investment deals. And under those, you only find one reference to social and environmental protections. It is tucked away in one particular category, which is treated as optional. So basically, countries are awarded what they call bonus points if they've got environmental and social protections, if they require that investors consult with local communities prior to the investment. But it's a bonus point. Essentially, what it means is countries that do not have those sort of social protections are not penalized at all. However, if we move away from the indicators, we find that there are other norms which amplify environmental and social protections as possibly or potentially being integral to the practice of doing business efficiently. More specifically, the IFC, in the paper we extract these norms from the IFC standards on environmental and social sustainability, as well as the FAO voluntary guidelines on responsible governance of tenure of land, fisheries and forests, as well as the principles for responsible agricultural investment. And the common theme that runs through these instruments is the fact of the primacy that is placed on the local communities. And in fact, the IFC standards acknowledge the fact that project-related land acquisition can result in landlessness, homelessness, joblessness, loss of common property and social disarticulation. There is more or less a consensus around the problems that can emanate from cross-border land investment use. And this is why they place a primacy on the free and prior informed consent of communities. And the IFC actually requires its clients to produce evidence of having had meetings and consultations with local communities. And whilst in none of these instruments will you find a specific direction that investors must partner with local communities, they are certainly encouraged and recommended to partner with local communities to be able to work together with indigenous people as development partners. However, the indicators award points for those countries whose legal frameworks do not require that an investor has to partner with any local player. So in fact, it is the exact opposite of what this other group of norms seeks to encourage. In fact, the indicators award points, because the indicators are structured in a form of their ratings rather than rankings, is not one list. You'd have to select the particular country in the particular category. But they reward countries which permit the leasing of unlimited amounts of land for unlimited periods of time. So, for example, if your country permits a lease for 50 years, that is divided by 100, so you get a point of 0.5. However, if a lease is permitted for 100 years or more, then the country gets the highest possible point of 1, for example. And countries are awarded points for not requiring governmental approval for investment deals, for example. Whereas, if you are to look into the FAO voluntary guidelines, they encourage governments to seek, to put in place parliamentary approval for these large-scale investment deals so that there can be a level of monitoring. So there is, at that level perhaps, and a phrase that I learned today is development consensus, but perhaps there is a level of ontological fissures as far as what model of development is being put forward. And I think yesterday Mr. Nihal Bhutta made reference to the fact that while once you start ranking countries based on the likelihood of a state to collapse or rating state fragility, then you are in fact advancing a theory of state strength, I think. And in this case, the indicators are advancing a theory of development, which from our findings is at odds with this other group of norms that one can find in the international development architecture. So in conclusion, we think that whilst we do not make the claim that the investing across borders indicators cause the land investment use that would amount to land grabbing, but they certainly act as enablers in encouraging the sort of frameworks in which land investment deals would more easily benefit the investors, as opposed to the local communities, as opposed to the host countries, as opposed to upholding social and environmental protections. One of the most remarkable thing about the land investment deals is that they are mostly being conducted in countries with weak formal recognition of rural land tenure rights, with weak governance structures. In fact, it is those countries where these very poor, it would seem there are those countries where there are weak governance structures that investors are seeking to invest more and more these cross-border land investment deals. And so we submit that the indicators could do more to incentivize governments. I think there was a reference to behavior change yesterday to encourage governments to set up those sort of frameworks which protect their citizens, as opposed to those that open their markets to foreign investors to the detriment of their own local communities. There's a quotation we put in the paper, which is not original, which says, doing business with extraordinarily high profits is not necessarily the same as doing business efficiently. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I pass the floor to Itai Apta from the Israel Ministry of Justice, who was representing Israel at the United Nations and at other corruption forums worldwide, who will share his insights on corruption indicators with us, having a presentation on creating milestones for future global corruption indicators. Please.
Thank you very much. First, obviously, I'm here in my personal capacity. Although you probably would not be too much shocked to learn that my presentation focuses on the role or the need to increase the role of governments in indicators. An additional preliminary remark, or maybe part of the discussion, is that my approach to indicators, and maybe it could lead to a wider scope discussion, but it seems to be necessary because I feel that even if we're talking about very different indicators, numbers or mortality rates, like was mentioned, and on the other hand, the rule of law, corruption, environment, etc., we can still find common ground and from that to have common solutions. Another issue I have with the definition, which was proposed yesterday and proposed in many of the papers, is the inclusion of ranking. In my view, even if we don't have rankings, and as you will see, especially in the area of corruption, that's problematic, and as also learned from some of the papers, there is resistance in governments to ranking. We can still have simplification if we, instead of ranking, instead of numbers, use a pass-fail system, which is in some of the examples on corruption, where a country or a view jurisdiction is determined by the international organization or by the sponsor or by the provider of the indicator to either implement the international standard or not implement, and then you can also build on that and say where if the review jurisdiction implements a recommendation or doesn't. And we also have numbers here, but we don't have ranking. And that could be a good solution. Looking at the different examples of corruption, we can see there are three models, if to very much simplify the issue, of corruption indicators, if we follow, of course, global corruption indicators, if we follow that very wide definition. So the first model would be the treaty model. And according to the treaty model, a treaty is served as the basis for the indicator or the basis for the standard. And we have now we have a great proliferation of that. We have the universal, almost universal, or close to universal treaty of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. We have the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, the African Union Convention, the OAS, the Organization of American States, the GRECO conventions against corruption and corruption focusing on criminal and civil aspects. So based on those treaties, we can see four characteristics, and of course I'll talk briefly, very briefly about each. The first one is that there's a lot of government input in the data collection. So the first stage, almost in every treaty or in every review mechanism, is to get information from governments. And we're talking about usually a set of 200, 300, 400 questions where governments have to respond. The second, when we're talking about corruption, is the focus on enforcement data. And as you'll see, and as many of you probably are aware, the Corruption Perception Index by Transparency International focuses on transparency, on perceptions, and not on enforcement data. And it seems that enforcement data, at least when we're coming to corruption, enforcement against corruption is what is relevant, less than if a country is perceived as corrupt or not. The third element would be that usually we're talking about, when we're talking about treaties, is consent by the governments. The governments, once they enter into the treaty, then they consent subsequently, or when they sign the treaty, they consent to be reviewed. And I think many of the indicators we discussed earlier don't have that element. And that could be not important maybe in some indicators, but when we're talking about if we want to see an indicator as a tool to encourage compliance, even if we can't use it to ensure compliance, then this must be, I think, it must be there. The other element when we're talking about government consent is that in many of the new mechanisms, we're talking about the OECD, the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, and probably in the future ones, governments are actively involved in compiling the results of the indicator. So if you have a report, or even a very brief executive summary of the report, as the example is in the context of the United Nations Convention, then the government can comment on the report, can indicate where it doesn't agree to the conclusion of the indicator. So that is also a very important issue. Component. The other component in treaties is the new idea, and now it's getting more and more prevalent, of peer review. Peer review is where two countries review the third one, or review their review jurisdiction, and at least in our experience and in the experience we have with international organization, that is very positive. It raises, of course, the legitimacy of the indicator with the review jurisdiction, and it provides governments, and again, maybe I think it was not said that governments should have a role, a very increasing role in the development. It provides them with an opportunity to affect the development of the indicators. And usually, usually the persons, the experts who are performing the peer review are not politicians. They're not, they are experts in their field, and they are not, usually not affected by political thinking, more professional focus. The second model, when we're talking about corruption, is the recommendation-based model. And although the kind of recommendations that we have in corruption, many of them are now effectively or realistically obligatory. So the best example in that is the anti-money laundering recommendations by the FATF, which is a body linked to the OECD, where they have a set of 40 recommendations which deal with anti-money laundering, plus 9 recommendations which deal with finance of terrorism. And in that sense, the FATF, together with the World Bank, apply reviews to jurisdictions, to almost all countries. In this model, we can see that this is based on non-consent, usually. There are relatively few countries who are members, which are members of the FATF, but still the reviews are carried out to all jurisdictions. And in that sense, that is problematic, although it was successful. But even the professional experts who are performing the reviews indicate in many instances that they feel it is problematic to apply a review with such ramifications, and there are ramifications. If the FATF recognize a high-risk jurisdiction, then usually banks impose very strict sanctions, and effectively the market in these countries cannot operate globally. So that's a problem. And in the sense of recommendation, we have the idea of naming and shaming, which was also brought up previously, and in that the application of political pressure. The last instrument, or the last model, is the standard model, and basically the two examples, and I think we discussed the doing business example extensively. The other example, which was also brought up, is the Corruption Perception Index by Transparency International, and the characteristics of this kind of standards is, first, that it's very vague standards. Transparency International, at least of what I try to understand, does not have a real specific definition of corruption. It focuses on perception and, of course, the idea of ranking, which is the most famous idea in the CPI. And the problem with that is not only the number, but also that in many cases when you see media sightings of the rankings, you see comparisons. So, for example, country X was number 90, and then country X was number 100. So the claim is that there's a deterioration in corruption. When even the Transparency International in their publications say that you can't compare between years because it's different experts, different systems, but there is so much temptation by international organizations, not only by media, to use those comparisons that's what happens. So, and of course, obviously, governments, at least in this ranking by TI, are not involved. And this is opposed to another ranking by other rankings by Transparency International, which do include governments, consultations with governments, when we're talking about the bribers, payers index, meaning that even if we do have rankings, we can involve governments. The other, briefly, the other two issues that should be referred to are what is the effect on decision-making and other, on decision-making in donor allocation, but I think very importantly in decision-making in the review jurisdiction. How is the government affected by the use of the indicator? And you can say that governments would best be affected, or you can imagine that would by rankings and by numbers, but if we look at the OECD UK example, where very briefly the UK has revolutionized its anti-bribery, anti-corruption legislation because of very strong scrutiny by the OECD and and a result of reviews by the OECD, which were reached the conclusion that the UK did not comply with the convention. And when we're talking about effect on governments, we also have to bear in mind the effects on private sectors. Private sector, I think that we're talking about corruption or other social phenomena, private sector has become much more relevant here, even maybe in the area of human rights. So once you have governments which are part of the process, which see legitimacy in the indicator, they themselves take it upon themselves to involve the private sector and to put pressure on compliance with the private sector. And in our example, Israel had received recommendations from the OECD in the field of regulation of defense exports. As a result of that recommendation, the Ministry of Defense in Israel changed its policy on the issue of anti-bribery. So again, that's a very good example. To sum up, I think that maybe if we want to solve some of the problems that were raised when we're talking about indicators, we can apply an approach to include more government participation, both in the design of the indicators and both in their development and use. Now, of course, this would necessitate compromise, because of course governments would have their own ideas about how they want to be reviewed and what kind of indicators, because they want to present positive aspects of governance. However, this can be offset if we say that the indicators must be public, and in the corruption context, at least all that I'm familiar with are public. Even in the United Nations aspect, there was a very big debate about whether to keep the results confidential or not, and at the end the compromise was that executive summaries of the reports are published, and at least in the sum of the executive reports which have been published for the past 2 years, there is specific reference to whether a state has implemented or not. And you can have the bottom line. Another offset would be to have recommendations and strict follow-up on recommendations. And then you can see whether a government implemented or not, and this is a very very important point, that a component of an indicator must be that you have recommendations on how to get better, how to improve. Otherwise, even if a government wants to be part of an indicator, wants to improve, then it's very difficult to do so if it doesn't know at least what is the spirit. Of course, it doesn't mean that you implement every recommendation, but at least it gives you an opportunity and might make it more clear. Finally, you can offset the compromise by involvement of NGOs, at least in the models, in the OECD model, and to some extent in the FATF model and the United Nations model, also probably in the GRECO, the European Council, and the African Union, you have a lot of involvement of NGOs. NGOs participate in meetings of the international organizations, NGOs participate in on-site visits by experts from the reviewing countries. And in the United Nations Convention context, according to the Convention, there is an obligation, according to the rules of the review mechanism or the indicator, there's an obligation to receive input from NGOs. So some of the examples we're aware of, NGOs have submitted shadow reports to the reviewing expert, and this could be included. So I think that if we reach this sort of recipe for indicators, at least where it is possible, I think that it could very much well help them to, or the indicators to achieve the goal that I think should be the only goal of an indicator, and that is to encourage compliance with international standards. Thank you.
Thank you. I will now pass the floor to the discussant. Kevin Davis will provide some comments, followed by Sarah Datouche from IFAD.
Thanks. I'm not Retzel Marta. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to make it. So, but these papers are both near, both touch on subjects that are near and dear to my heart. So I was very happy to be able to provide some comments. Basically, I will use this opportunity to talk about how the papers illustrate some difficulties that are, that I think are inherent in the study and design of indicators. So first of all, for Araya and David, I think this is really important work. Their paper is a detailed study, detailed analysis of the production process for a specific indicator where they've gone in and tried to uncover the biases that are inherent in the indicator that would not otherwise be evident from someone who just picks up a World Bank report and says, oh, this is how easy it is to do business in Kenya or Ethiopia or whatever. So I think this is terrifically important work for scholars to be undertaking. And they have some interesting findings, not only the fact that the indicator doesn't pick up on the social and environmental impacts, but this idea that it potentially is contradictory to other World Bank norms and maybe undermines those norms and in a way maybe elevates the importance, this is not something you mentioned in the presentation, but elevates the importance of the international standards by undermining domestic ones. So I thought that was all terrifically useful. There are some drawbacks, though, to this approach of homing in on just the production process of just one indicator. And I just want to mention two. One is the fact that you then exclude all the other information about the subject that might be available to potential users, right, by just focusing on the indicator. So as you mentioned in the paper in one of the footnotes, the IFC seems to have a response to the concerns you raise about the exclusion of the social and environmental data from their investing across borders indicator. They say, well, the indicators should not be considered in isolation, but in conjunction with other indicators and reports that reflect the country's other needs, circumstances, and socioeconomic development. So they're saying, we know this doesn't capture everything. You should look at other information as alongside the IAB indicator. And if that's right, it does call into question whether you can actually say, as you do in the paper, well, this indicator encourages countries to ignore social and environmental considerations. Well, in isolation, yes, but if you take into account everything the World Bank does, perhaps not. At least that's a question that I think is raised by the approach that you've taken. The other question is, well, can you really evaluate an indicator without taking into account the use, right? Because you focus again on the production process, what data is included, but, and then you say, well, you speculate, I think, about how it's likely to be used. Well, users will look at this indicator and decide to, in the case of the investors, not to invest in countries that make it difficult to invest by attaching all these social and environmental safeguards, or if the users are the countries, they'll decide to strip away their environmental and social protections. That's possible, but it's without actually going out and investigating all of that, we don't know for sure. So there's that inherent limitation of this approach of just focusing on the production. We don't necessarily know how it's going to be used afterwards, which, again, is really another project. I'm not suggesting that this is something you should have done in the paper, but the approach here has that inherent limitation that we don't actually know what's going to happen to this indicator once it's gone out into the world and combined, once it's put out into the world combined with other information and used in potentially different ways. So that's all I really wanted to say about the paper, as opposed to getting further into the details of it, which I think are actually tremendously illuminating. So for Itai, your paper was much more, and your presentation were much more prescriptive about here's what we should do, here's how we should go about designing indicators. So I'll respond to it in that vein. But first, a preliminary mark. The definition of indicators. I prefer narrower definitions. Just for the sake of conceptual precision, I think it's important to know what we're talking about so that we can compare things properly. So in the paper, you characterize a wide range of legal instruments as indicators. You treat treaties and Financial Action Task Force recommendations alongside the Corruption Perceptions Index as indicators. And I would have reserved the term for just the Corruption Perceptions Index and would have treated the legal instruments as something else. Now, there are indicators that are produced that measure compliance with those legal instruments and in the process of measuring compliance with the instruments and so forth. That's just a matter of personal taste. As far as the rest of the paper, what I found interesting was that it really illustrates how difficult it is to design a good indicator. So take three of your recommendations, right? One was that the indicators have to include that indicators of compliance with anti-corruption instruments have to include data on enforcement, because enforcement is critical. I think that's actually quite contestable, right? Is enforcement of anti-corruption norms, domestic enforcement of anti-corruption norms, actually the principal way to go about reducing corruption? Perhaps. The experience in Hong Kong with their Independent Commission Against Corruption is, I think, the story that gives everyone hope. That's a sort of founding myth in this area. They, in the 1970s, corruption was rampant in Hong Kong. They created this independent commission that launched a vigorous enforcement campaign, especially against corruption in the police force, and they had immediate results. Corruption, by any measure, dropped dramatically afterwards. I'm not sure that many other countries have replicated that level of success with purely enforcement-driven campaigns. And even in Hong Kong, there are two other components to the initiative. There was a prevention component and also an educational component, right? So prevention involved going into government ministries or encouraging government ministries to approach the commission for advice on how to redesign their processes to reduce the opportunities for corruption. And the educational component involved going out into schools and so forth and to the ministries to basically teach people that corruption was bad. I think it's a contested empirical issue as to whether or not those kinds of initiatives are going to be more or less effective than just enforcement. So I'm not sure how relevant enforcement data is actually across all countries. So it's an interesting question and whether that should be the priority. So that was one of your comments, your recommendations. A second one was that the indicators should be specific and actionable. Right, I think that's the term that's used in other contexts. So you criticize the Corruption Perceptions Index for being too vague, too broad. Governments don't know what they have to do in order to improve their score on the Corruption Perceptions Index. So we need something more specific. That's what the World Bank these days is calling an actionable governance indicator that you can actually look at and say, here are the actions I have to take in order to improve our performance. There are obvious advantages to that. To having those kinds of indicators. So an indicator that measures, say, that's more specific and says, well, have you implemented the provision of the UN Convention Against Corruption that says you have to enact legislation that criminalizes foreign bribery? That would be a much more specific indicator, very actionable. You know exactly what you have to do to comply with it. I don't know, though, whether it's actually any more valid as a measure of whether people are complying with the spirit of the legislation, whether they're actually striving to reduce corruption in their country. You might then have to take into account other measures. And so there's all, and perhaps broader, more vague measures, like, is the government committed to anti-corruption efforts? That's pretty vague, but it may actually be more valid. So I think there's often going to be a trade-off between, say, the specificity of an indicator and true validity. So it's, again, I just found that interesting. The third recommendation you mentioned was you wanted more government. The world needs more government in the production of indicators. And this issue of how to organize the production of indicators, what's the best way, is a difficult one. Again, from my perspective, just to play devil's advocate here, why not just have more indicators? right? More privately produced indicators. What's wrong with markets as opposed to governments? A market for indicators, perhaps with some government involvement, so the government could come in and endorse particular indicators, say, well, this one's a bit more reliable than that one. You know, what Transparency International is doing is a bit more reliable and useful than what, say, this other fly-by-night operation is doing. But still, that there is an alternative approach, right? This market-based approach that would allow for more pluralism, and it can still be combined with government intervention, and actually that's what we have right now, right? So when the World Bank puts out its indicators, they're actually composite indicators where they've picked from different privately produced, well, privately and publicly produced indicators. They've tested them using all their fancy econometric techniques to see which ones are most reliable, and then they produce their own indicator that's really a composite. So I'm not clear on why you would, or if you're suggesting moving away from that to giving the government more market power and more of a monopoly on production, and if so, what the justification for that approach would be. So that's all.
Thank you. Sarah?
Thank you. And I am. I just wanted to apologize on behalf of Rutzel Marta. He was not able to attend because there was an emergency meeting at IFAD. So I will just speak very briefly and try to bring a little bit of what I got from reading the two papers together out. So it seemed to me that one thing that the papers both helped conceive for me was to think about the factors that play into our consideration of the need to produce, but also to modify and supplement indicators. So I identified three factors. One is the multiplicity of stakeholders. The second is the subjectivity of the thing that we are trying to measure. And the third is conflicts among users of a particular indicator. So just on the multiplicity point, it sort of picks up on something that Itai says in his paper, which is where he says that one of the things that sort of started to generate these standards around corruption was the realization that corruption is not a victimless crime, right? So if you think about, you know, one corrupt act, that on its own won't necessarily generate a problem, but once you start to accumulate corrupt acts, the problem can actually appear and escalate to affect the economy and general condition of a country, and then extending internationally, this would affect global dynamics as well. Similarly, I think with investments in land, you could have, you know, an investment that is not problematic, or maybe slightly problematic. It turns into land grabbing. It turns into an international phenomenon as these transactions start to multiply, which is something that we've been seeing. And as we see this sort of augmentation of problematic transactions, the set of stakeholders that are implicated by a particular indicator grows. And so I think that one feature that brings the two papers together is that the multiplicity of stakeholders will lead us to both produce on the one hand, but also to then modify the indicator as we become aware of the different voices and actors who are affected by the indicator. The second factor was the subjectivity, and this picks up on something that that Kevin said earlier, that to the extent that there are differing views about what constitutes corruption or or how we can measure the social impact of displacement of rural people from their land as the result of land grabbing, we need to be paying particular attention to how the indicators flex and adjust to solve the problem or to help us assess the problem. So subjectivity is something that in both cases seemed to point to a need to continuously review the indicators. And the third point, which came out primarily in David and Araya's paper, was we will feel a need to review indicators where we see a user problem. So just building on what Kevin was saying, he was talking about the user as the businesses. The other user of these instruments are policymakers. So to the extent that policymakers are being, you know, pushed in two directions at the same time to score high on one indicator, you have to score low on another indicator, that might also create an impetus to review the indicator, to review the indicators at hand. So I just wanted to point out these three, keep it very brief, and indicate as well that both papers seem to really converge on the view that indicators need to be will evolve naturally, but also need to be the subject of a continuous review process. And I think that these three can help us. These three factors could help us to conceive in a sort of more systematic way of how and when we need to review the indicators.
Thank you very much. Before I open the floor, I will abuse a little bit my position as a chair and make some comments myself on the presentations, which I found very interesting. I actually would like to pick up what came up several times now to the market-based approach of indicators and to the plurality of indicators. I think that's very important. But I also think that I see actually a lot of indicators which are out there which no one is actually using. There's a lot of information which is not being used. So for the market to work, for the market-based approach to work, I think there are two issues you need to take into account. The first one is the issue of real transparency and the role of academics in explaining indicators and the assumptions behind them to the general public in case the authors of the indicators don't do so. And what I see a lot is that there was mentioning of the fancy econometric techniques, that there's a lot of hiding behind the fancy econometric techniques. You can back up a lot of your work by coming up with fancy econometric calculations that most of the people in the audience are not going to understand. And I think there's a real role of the academics in really digging, and finding out what this actually implies in terms of hidden assumptions and implications for the rankings of the countries. It also assumes that we have all this information that the best ones survive, and I'm not sure if that's always the case. I think those which are mostly used are often those which respond to the demand. So simple information, nothing too complex, etc. So this is usually summary measurements which just summarize everything else which is out there, and which sometimes also summarize away all the differences which might have been there in underlying sources. And it's these differences which are sometimes interesting to look at. For instance, if you summarize citizens' assessments and assessments of commercial risk rating agencies, if you just summarize this somehow together, you may lose some information on how corruption might, or how citizens and businesses might be differently affected by corruption in countries, which then would provide more information on how countries should react to it. A last comment I can't, of course, refrain from making on the government involvement in constructing rankings. In working at the OECD, and I'm responsible for creating and designing indicators and implementing the measurement process for the field of regulatory policy and governance at the OECD, I have to admit that I find that process of dialogue with countries actually pretty useful. We have our legal instrument in that sense is the recommendations on regulatory policy and governance. And as all these documents are usually negotiated with countries, they can be pretty vague at the end. I mean, some of the content, for instance, is that there should be public consultation on new rulemaking, there should be the law should be accessible to everyone in an easy way, that there should be publication of evidence that's being used for lawmaking processes. Now, the construction of the indicators can be pretty helpful, this dialogue with countries, in making it more concrete, because otherwise it can stay at a pretty abstract level where everyone agrees with it. But obviously, to make it a bit more ambitious and making sure that countries are implementing it, it's actually pretty useful in having that dialogue with countries on how you measure it. And in that process, you also understand more about the legal systems of the different countries and the implications several questions can have. Of course, here again, I agree with what was put out, that it needs to be transparently put outside the organization as well, so that there can be some contestation, and that all the information and data is available, and that academics can say, I disagree with those scores or the ways that indicators have been constructed. I think that's very important. So let me now open the floor for other comments. I already have one person here listed. Okay, great. So I take the first three, and then maybe we give an opportunity to the presenters to react, and then we can have another round of comments. Please.
Thank you. I had in mind one remark and one question, and I have to add one right away because I cannot agree more what our chair said about the need of transparency, about the way and the methods indicators are shaped and made. And I just had that this is a most powerful antidote to any hidden strategy, to any hidden economic or political strategy in exercising the global public authority that is embedded in the use of indicators in global governance. The remark bridges the two fascinating sessions we had this morning and start from a reply to what Mikhail Rigna said in his final words of his intervention. I don't find legal positivism boring at all. But I do think that in studying the legal dimensions of indicators in global governance, it tends to be part of the problem rather than part of the solution. What I mean? Yeah, I mean that most of indicators, especially when they deal with economic issues, with economic affairs, are set up in a way that make one think that the official legal system is everywhere the key controller of social behavior, of economic behavior, of private conduct, of social conduct. This is true up to a certain extent in the West, but it is not certainly true outside the West, where different factors shape legal frameworks that are different from the state-posited law. And these are factors that the mainstream international legal debate treats as sources of social norms. And the language itself is a proxy for an attitude, an ideology that sees law as posited by the state. And whatever is not posited by the state can be part of the norm area, space, but then becomes social norms. As a matter of fact, these social norms are the norms by which most of the people outside the West abide in many, many sectors. And this is not usually included in the radar screen of the indicators. My question, I go to the question, and this is related to what I've just said, is to Araya and Ofisi. Land grabbing is, and the IAB is a fascinating issue. I just wonder whether this effort is aware that one of the major problems in development in approaching economic development in sub-Saharan Africa especially is given by the lack of land registers, by the lack of effective land registers, and that in that tradition the land entitlements usually belong to a specific community within which there's an allocation of title entitlements to subgroups or families. And this has blurred many of the development approach to the land in Africa. And I'm wondering whether the question is if this would be indicators is taking account this issue, and is taking account that in some countries like Tanzania, Ethiopia, Malawi, Sierra Leone, and Central African Republic, that there's been a move towards the registration of communal and traditional titles.
Thank you very much. We're unfortunately running a bit out of time, so I have three questions. If you could be brief, that would be fantastic. Nehal, please.
Okay, I will try to be brief. So I guess my question or comment is really in relation to the land grabbing paper. I mean, in many ways, the example that you give for me puts into question or problematizes the ideas of sort of pluralism and regulation as possible responses to the construction of the indicator. And the reason that I say that is, first, that you know, the notions of a pluralism or a market in information as a solution to bad information, it's not clear that it's entirely applicable to the way in which indicators get used. I think I echo Christiana's skepticism that that the credibility of the number is not the critical feature, and so proliferation of numbers may have no impact whatsoever. There are important questions of social power as to how an indicator becomes consecrated as important, and so that leads me to really to the question about you know, if you look at the way in which the investing across borders indicator is framed, it clearly prioritizes a very strong conception of a very strong model of transactional ease in investment to the exclusion of others. Now, the question is that resolved simply by saying, well, take into account other information? It might be, but that begs the question about what the value of promoting this norm is. Is it why is it that the indicator has been designed in this way, and what objectives were sought to be achieved by it? And what's the result of it being consecrated by the bank as a statement about the nature of the ease of investment? And is that really responded to adequately by pointing to other sources of information, or is it really necessary to demand a fundamental change in the production of the indicator so as to mitigate the sort of symbolic consequences of its of the bank consecrating it in this way?
Ariel, please.
Yes, thank you. I'll try to be as brief as possible. It's more a comment about what has been discussed this morning, but also yesterday. It's about this this cleavage that we always confronted to when we talk about indicators, which is the difference between objectivity and subjectivity. This always comes up. I mean, as a question, and I think that we should go beyond this divide. Because I think indicators are neither objective nor subjective. I mean, they're not objective from my perspective as far as social sciences are not objective if you believe that the definition of objectivity has to be grounded in the definition of the objectivity of hard sciences. That's a huge debate. It's very sort of summarized comment, but I'm happy to talk about it later, lunchtime, or whatever. And so therefore, if we focus about should they need do indicators need to be objective, I think we're going the wrong way. On the other hand, I mean, they're also not totally subjective. I mean, if you think, yes, I mean, Sweden is more credit worthy than Greece right now. I mean, and it will be hard to make the case that it is the opposite. And so, I mean, they are in between those two categories. And I think that what is the point here is the relation between the means, the epistemic means, and the social and political functions of those tools. That is to say, are they well fit to do what they think and what they say that they have to do? And do they adapt to the situation where, I mean, they have to be used, and also the objects, the persons, and the institutions that they have to evaluate. And I think here, what there was a question yesterday about what is a global indicator. Well, a global indicator, I was thinking about the sort of a Nokia function of the indicator. A good indicator is an indicator that connects people. And you can see, you can measure the spread of an indicator between borders, between state, between different sectors of society, whether it brings consensus or not. And so therefore the job of those who want to promote a debate on indicators is to promote a discussion about whether you agree or not with the indicator. And not only when you get bad grades. What strikes me with the credit rating agencies is that there's a debate only when certain states get bad grades and they disagree with it. But they never disagree when they get good grades. It's like at a university. I mean, you have a student, so in American university, he comes to you when he gets a bad grade and he discusses the bad grade. But never when he gets a good one. So the thing is promoting a public global debate, intersectorial debate about the validity and the functionality of the indicator.
Thank you. One last question by Marco, and then if the two speakers could briefly comment, that would be great.
Yes, thank you. I would like to make a very brief remark on indicators based on perception. Notably on the indicators on corruption. It has been argued in many cases that indicators based on perception would be less reliable or less accurate maybe than those based on data, on the objective indicators. Well, I think this is true, but it's also true that often perception reflects expectations, is very connected with expectations. And we all know that how important expectations are in economic or social behaviors. So taking on the suggestion of Sabino Cassese on pluralism in indicators and of Giulio Napolitano approach based on the game theory, maybe we could ask to ourselves if even if these indicators are more empirical or more uncertain in results, maybe public bodies may have some interest in measuring and influencing perception and expectations in these terms. Thank you.
David and Araya, would you like to make some concluding comments?
Well, I think most of them, just we simply accept them and we agree with the comments and suggestions, as you say. But one point that the IFC document puts information so that we didn't address that one is that, yes, you're right, Kevin Davis. Yeah. They say that we have to use indicators along with other indicators, but we try to see that they have already identified that there is a need for social and environmental indicators, but they put them at optional level, and we're questioning that one. Why they have already identified that, but why they treat them at subsidiary level or as not important ones. So we're trying that. Maybe this document was released by 2010, maybe in the coming issue, we hope that they will upgrade them to the mandatory level and they will no more be at optional level. And because they also say that this is a working document, or is they don't even rank countries as at this level, and they are still stabilizing the methodologies. And then we hope that in the coming one, in the coming issue, they will upgrade these issues to the standard level. Yeah, I think that's what we have on this one. That's what we sent it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'll just say very quickly. In another one of the caveats, the indicators actually state that they do not seek to encourage governments to sacrifice social and environmental protections just to be a good source for foreign direct investment. So I think what we were attempting to do, perhaps poorly so, was to convey the idea that it is insufficient to claim you do not encourage that when the scope, the effect of the framing of the indicators achieves just that. And trying to highlight the paradox of having an objective of protecting the environment and having social protections, but then all you do is have a white elephant hidden somewhere within more stringent sort of measurements of the sort of indicators that benefit investors. And I think the reference to the problem of title in Africa, land registration, yes, it's conceded, and yes, we're aware of it. And in fact, perhaps it speaks to the remark I made earlier, the fact that it's almost ironic that countries with weak governance structures in this case are a very big destination for these sort of investments. And in most scenarios, it is the absence of rural land title and communal land tenure that makes it easier for communities to be displaced. And so it is almost like that very urgent need for land reform in a lot of the countries where the investments are taking place are not taking place because of the predominance of land tenure, which is not the same as formal land tenure. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Ito?
Thank you. Just very briefly, just to relate to some of the comments. First, and I'd like to comment on the more principled issue when we're talking about enforcement. Actually, I think it's an example of when we're talking about other indicators, not necessarily on corruption, on the issue of whether you should take into account action by governments or not. Of course, it doesn't mean that action by governments should be the only thing. If we look at all the indicators, it's enforcement is a component. It could be we also have prevention, we have education, all the things that were mentioned by Kevin. And I think that in general, what the more principled issue is that I think that when we have an indicator that government action, whatever it is, enforcement, preserving human rights, etc., should be taken into account. And the problem with using perception, although perception is very relevant, is usually, and this is apparent in the corruption example or other examples, if government takes a lot of action, then usually when we're talking about democratic countries where there's free media, then it increases perception of the problem. So let's say if we're talking about human rights, when government enforces a lot of human rights against a lot of human rights violation, even though this is a good and positive thing, then the perception is that there is more human rights violation, and then the lower scores or criticism. And the other issue is government involvement. I think, of course, I join Christiane. I think, of course, we don't need to move away even from the proliferation of indicators, although I think maybe we can limit them in some cases. I only think what I propose is that governments, that when international organizations or even NGOs undertake to compile indicator, that they consult with governments and that they give governments an opportunity to respond and be part of a process. I think that generally, if we're talking about global governance, if we want governments to see global governance as legitimate, then they must be included in the process in some form or other. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, the presenters and those involved in the discussion. We now move to the coffee break, which is in the same room as yesterday, and it would be great if you could be back here in about 20 minutes at 11:40. Thank you.